Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yeah. Started to burn too many things we found. This is Solartopia back at with you for another week in the coming age of renewable energy and grassroots democracy. That was Darrell Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song on the Grammy-winning album Tomorrow's Children. As a matter of fact, we got a lot to talk about today, of course, in the shadow of the horrible slaughter in Las Vegas, yet another mass murder brought to you by the National Rights Association, a refusal to deal with gun control. It's insane, and it's got to stop, as I'm sure everybody agrees. I did see Jimmy Kimmel on this. He was absolutely terrific. Who knew that our political opposition would finally center in late-night talk shows, but it's better than nothing, folks. So we got to do something about this. But today we're going to talk about a different kind of gun control and drug control and all that stuff. In the first half hour, we're going to talk about American Made, the amazing Tom Cruise movie. I never thought I'd talk about Tom Cruise movie on this show. Tom Cruise did make one spectacular movie. One of the great movies, actually, of the American catalog, which is Born on the 4th of July. He played Ron Kovic. He was absolutely tremendous. I think he got the Oscar for that. I'm not sure. And he has since come out in this movie, American Made. We're going to be talking with Danny Sheehan and Sarah Nelson, who have been with us before. And we just had this unlikely conversation because Danny and Sarah were at the core of breaking the Iran contra stories. And then in the second half hour, we're going to talk with Mark Summer, and Danny and Sarah may stay with us. We may have got a call from Paul Kangas. We're going to talk about solarizing Puerto Rico and converting that whole island to microgrids. So stay with us. It's a pretty powerful hour. So Danny Sheehan, Sarah Nelson, are you with us?
I'm right here, Sluggo.
All right,
I don't know where Sarah is. She's in the middle of a meeting somewhere.
All right, well, if she calls in, that'll be great, and I'm sure you can carry the ball. We love having Sarah with us. But okay, yeah. So you and I have been having a lot of conversations lately, and you mentioned in one of our conversations that this new movie, American Made, was about Iran-Contra, and you hadn't seen it when we talked about it. And so I actually went and saw it with a bunch of people, and I thought it was astounding. So I want you, I know that many of our listeners have not yet seen this movie, American Made. And I keep recommending it to my friends, and they keep telling me, well, I don't know about Tom Cruise. I mean, come on, man. So, Danny, you've now seen it. I called you after my friends and I saw the movie. You said it was 85% true. So I want you, and yeah, only you can do, if you would, to run through the story of Barry Seals, through this movie, and tell us what the real story is, please. Because I know after listening to this, a lot of my listeners are going to go see this movie. I'm going to write about it. I was just floored. I mean, absolutely floored by this movie. And nobody knows. Nobody seems to know how radical it really is. So give us the rundown, Danny. Danny Sheehan of the Romero Institute. Tell us what American Made is all about.
Well, it is a modified story about Barry Seal. Barry Seal was a pilot that was flying military equipment from the Enterprise. The Enterprise having been run in most everybody's mind by Oliver North, who was the deputy director of the National Security Council under the Reagan-Bush administration in charge of anti-terrorism. And he in fact was smuggling weapons and having a whole cadre of pilots fly military equipment down to the Contras, who were the former National Guard, extreme right-wing fascist National Guard for Anastasio Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua. When Nicaragua, the Nicaraguan dictatorship was overthrown by the people, led by the Sandinista Revolutionary Movement, the Reagan-Bush administration basically wanted to go to war against them because they were not going to toe the mark and submit themselves to the control of the American government in Latin America, not submit to the Monroe Doctrine, not acknowledge that the United States had the right to exercise a sphere of influence over them. They were going to have relations with China, with Russia, with other countries of the world. And so, much like Cuba, the Reagan-Bush administration declared an informal war against them. The problem was
against the Sandinistas.
The American, pardon?
Against the Sandinistas.
The American,
Ronald Reagan, as I recall, and I'm old enough to remember this, Ronald Reagan likened the Contras in Nicaragua
to the founding fathers of our country.
Washington, Franklin.
That's what he said.
And these guys were just street thugs.
Yeah, and they were just total fascists that were in the National Guard of Anastasio Somoza. Anastasio Somoza was the grandson of the original Anastasio Somoza that was put in power back in 1915 by General Smedley Butler, and a major American intervention under the auspices of United Fruit at the behest of the Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm and Brown Brothers Harriman. And the bottom line is that the Sandinista finally ended up successfully overthrowing that dictatorship. And they came into power, and the Reagan-Bush administration decided that they wanted to oust them. But the United States Congress, which was the House of Representatives, was under the control of the Democrats, and they refused to authorize any money to be used for the counterattack against the Sandinista government. And so what happened is that there was a off-the-shelf enterprise that had been started actually by the CIA, the covert operations director, and the former CIA station chief in Saigon, Theodore Shackley. It had been started at the end of the Vietnam War because the ultra-right-wing elements inside the Central Intelligence Agency believed that they were being betrayed by the Carter administration and also even by the Nixon administration. And so what they had done is they had set up a mechanism by means of which they could continue to wage a hardcore right-wing, anti-communist, pro-fascist set of military operations around the world by stealing weapons in Vietnam and reporting them falsely as having been lost to the communists in the waning months of the Vietnam War. This was all choreographed by Theodore G. Shackley, the former CIA station chief in Saigon, founder of the Phoenix Program, and who later became the chief of covert operations worldwide under George H.W. Bush in the Ford administration from 1974 to 1976 when Jimmy Carter came into power. Now, because Jimmy Carter was in power from 1976 to 1980, and the hardcore right-wing forces wanted to attack and oust the Sandinista government, they began to provide military equipment and arms to the former National Guard people. And that whole operation was being conducted by the off-the-shelf enterprise run by Theodore Shackley. And they began to recruit an entire alternative government, actually. They brought in to run their air operations Richard V. Secord. He was the former director of the Defense Security Assistance Administration, providing military equipment to foreign powers by the American government and the Pentagon. He retired and was recruited by the enterprise. Theodore Shackley, who was the head of covert operations for George H.W. Bush and the CIA, was running the operation in retirement. They brought in Jack Singlaub, who was the head of U.S. forces in South Korea, who'd been fired by Jimmy Carter for refusing to obey orders and publicly insulting the president. And he was terminated, forced into retirement, not unlike General MacArthur previously in that position. So this whole group started organizing this off-the-shelf enterprise. Barry Seal became a pilot for this off-the-shelf enterprise, and he was flying guns down into the Contras, down in Central America. And he was smuggling cocaine back into the United States. And they were selling this cocaine in the United States. The cocaine was being produced by a Medellin cocaine cartel, one of the major people of which was Pablo Escobar and Jorge Ochoa. We named both of those guys as defendants in our federal criminal racketeering charges that we filed against the enterprise 6 months before Ed Meese ever acknowledged that Oliver North was doing this. We filed a major federal civil racketeering case.
Okay, so Danny Sheehan of the Romero Institute, what you have just said is, you know, a slight mouthful here. What you said is that the CIA had this guy, Barry Seals, flying planes. He was running guns down to the Contras, who were a fascist organization. Of course, this was illegal because Congress had said that you couldn't do this, run guns to these guys.
That's right.
But they're running illegal. Our Central Intelligence Agency is running illegally running guns to the Contras with this guy, Barry Seals, who was a former TWA pilot, on planes that the CIA provided him. They actually gave him an airfield, a 2,000-acre airfield in Mena, Arkansas. And somewhere along the line, he hooks up with the Medellin cartel and the infamous Pablo Escobar and starts on his return trips from running guns down to Central America. He comes back with cocaine. And the CIA knows this. Is this right?
Well, it was more than the CIA knew it. The CIA have been deeply involved since its origins in 1947, under the National Security Act of 1947. They'd been directly involved in smuggling heroin from Southeast Asia through Havana with the mafia and having it sold in the United States to help secretly fund the Kuomintang, the so-called nationalist Chinese in China who were opposing Mao.
Mao Zedong.
The Mao Zedong. This has been going on for some time. So Theodore Shackley, who had been the station chief, the CIA station chief, originally in Laos and then in Saigon, he in fact was a partner with the major opium trafficker in Laos, by a guy by the name of Vang Pao. They'd been smuggling heroin, copying what the U.S. CIA had been doing for a long time to support the Kuomintang. So he was smuggling opium into the United States, working with the mafia in Corsica, and they were providing the money through that means to support a massive political assassination program in Southeast Asia called the Phoenix Program. So Theodore Shackley is the main culprit in this whole thing. And when he felt betrayed by the United States formally pulling out of Vietnam and sort of pulling back from this major worldwide anti-communist activity they were engaged in, or the pro-fascist activity they were engaged in, after the public criticisms by Frank Church in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Abuse and all of that that arose after the Watergate burglary, the U.S. government officially was pulling back from all of those kind of activities. And this off-the-shelf enterprise run by Theodore Shackley out of Southeast Asia took over for them. And so originally Barry Seal was actually smuggling cocaine for them. It wasn't the CIA. The CIA came back in charge when Reagan and Bush came back into office after Carter was thrown out of there by this October surprise. And they moved back in, and Bill Casey, who became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, began actively working directly with the off-the-shelf enterprise, pretending that it was not the CIA doing it. And it was some private group of people that were doing this. And it was the off-the-shelf enterprise. Everybody who was running the whole thing being major high-level U.S. government officials in covert operations for the CIA or in weapons supply in the U.S. Pentagon. And they were all doing it. And the Congress of the United States was basically blithely going along saying, we've passed the Boland Amendment prohibiting you from doing this officially. And so the administration was saying, we were not doing this officially. There were just some private people doing it. Well, we sued the private people, the Christic Institute in Washington, D.C.
Right.
Yeah.
We
filed the federal racketeering lawsuit against them and exposed them publicly.
So what happens now is that the CIA is running a parallel operation, let's put it that way, a loosely affiliated
That's
operation,
right.
where they're sending guns down to the countries illegally. And then this guy, Barry Seal, builds a business bringing cocaine back from Central America and doing drops, airdrops, into the swamps in Louisiana and Arkansas. And that cocaine becomes the basis of the crack epidemic in the United States in the 1980s. And Ronald Reagan
and the cocaine epidemic. Yeah, both of them. The fact of the matter is that this was being run with the full knowledge of the Central Intelligence Agency, because I directly interviewed a guy by the name of Joseph Burkholder Smith, who was the deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City under Theodore Shockley, when Shockley was taken out of Southeast Asia and made the head of the Western Hemisphere operations. I talked directly with Joseph Burkholder Smith. He told me directly that he was allowed to stay on as the deputy CIA station chief when Shockley came in to run Western Hemisphere operations in 1973, on the explicit exception that he had to agree not to interfere with the cocaine trafficking that was being undertaken by the Medellin cocaine cartel. He was taken directly by Nasser Haro, the head of the DFS, which is in Mexico, the head of the CIA and FBI combined. He took him personally to a meeting in Salta, in Argentina, sat him down at a barbarian inn with these six guys with a swastika flag on the mantelpiece right over the top of him. And they told him that he was not going to be allowed to stay on as a deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City unless he agreed to allow the cocaine to be flowing. So this is
a
private brainchild of Barry Seal.
So here we have the federal government under Ronald Reagan prosecuting this horrendous drug war, putting thousands and thousands of mostly black and Hispanic Americans into prisons for doing drugs that the CIA itself was bringing into the United States.
That's right.
That's right.
God. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Sarah. How are you? Sarah Nelson is joining us as well.
I'd like to interject something here, if I could, please. At that time, we could see the amount of cocaine coming into the country on the graphs, because the government was tracking it and putting out the figures of how much more was coming in every year. It was just a straight climb, and it got so much cocaine was coming into the country that they stopped figuring it out and telling us. You know, they stopped announcing how much was coming in because it was so dramatic. In our neighborhood in Washington, D.C., where we lived at the time when we were doing all this work at the Christic Institute, we saw people becoming addicted. They would stop at our house and knock on the door at 5 a.m. or 5 p.m. and say they needed $15 for gas to take their father to the hospital, but it was really $15 for crack. And we were doing speeches all over the country, and I remember when we were doing speeches up in the very northern part of the country in northern Wisconsin and Michigan, people were saying to us, we do not understand what's happening to us. There's a cocaine all over our neighborhoods, and we don't know how it got there, and we've never had hard drugs in our neighborhoods. These were like small towns, rural areas, and it was going everywhere. We have to remember that now we have this with OxyContin and heroin.
I want to remind people, we're talking about the cocaine traffic and the movie American Made with Tom Cruise, which I am telling everybody to see. And Danny, we asked you immediately after seeing it Monday night, you said it's 85% true. So people, when you go to see
part of what wasn't true about it is they pretended at the very beginning of the movie that Tom Cruise was just this kind of devil may care TWA pilot, you know, jock, and he sort of got recruited into doing this as a sidebar. He'd been running guns for the Central Intelligence Agency into Cuba, you know, since 1961, 62, when he was 17, 18 years old. So I mean, that was part of the movie that was completely untrue. This guy had been directly working. He was in the Louisiana State National Guard and working directly with David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald. This is vastly more interesting and complex than people think. He didn't just fall out of the sky from TWA.
Sarah, you've raised an interesting connection, which I want to pursue. How much of the war in Afghanistan is a rerun of the cocaine traffic in Central America and the heroin traffic from Vietnam? I mean, is the war in Afghanistan really about opium and poppies, and is that where the opioid epidemic is coming from?
Well, that's a question that I have. Here's the thing. When we were in Vietnam, Nixon had a war on drugs because we were getting so much heroin coming into the country. It was coming right out of the Golden Triangle and was being trafficked by the CIA. When we had the covert war going on in Nicaragua after the Congress said don't do it, over there it was a covert war in Laos and Cambodia where we weren't supposed to be doing what we were doing. Then we had this huge cocaine guns for drugs operation going on. Then we go to Afghanistan, and now we have a heroin epidemic. And I have no love at all or respect for the Taliban, but we have to say that when they were in power, they got rid of the poppies. They stopped the poppy growing. And when we came in to have the war in Afghanistan after 9/11, all the poppies started growing again. I mean, that's a fact.
So
it's the warlords that were working directly with the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. American government in Afghanistan. They were the ones that were trafficking the opium in Afghanistan. And the CIA was letting them do it because it was a method of them making money and paying them, you know. So the problem is we have to be careful here, Sluggo, because if people says this is just totally, absolutely absurd, and then
right.
People will think that the world is just completely crazy and out of control. It's not. This is a very specific, long-term, covert operation on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency's Operations Directorate that has been using opium, heroin, cocaine to fund operations to avoid having Congress have to finance operations such as the Phoenix program, massive assassination programs,
right?
So the people in Congress can pretend they don't know. Now, what we need to address here is that I met directly with Tip O'Neill and with Claiborne Pell in the United States Congress when we discovered this and told them all about it. They agreed that if they could come back into controlling the Senate in November of 1986, that they would investigate this. And they asked, and they told me that you should have John Kerry be the guy put in charge of that investigation. John Kerry got put in charge of the investigation as proposed, and in fact, he shut the whole thing down. That we were bringing them evidence with tail numbers on the airplanes, shipping invoices, you know, the near serial numbers on the weapons, secret code words you use to land, landing strips all through Central America, all about Barry Seal. We're the ones that uncovered Mena, Arkansas. It was the Christic Institute that went in and investigated it on the ground. It wasn't the FBI or anybody else. We went in, Gene Wheaton, one of our professional investigators, went in and I assigned him to go there to follow up on the investigation, and here we're the ones that broke the whole thing. We're the ones that sat down and gave the information directly to Bill Clinton when he was the governor of Arkansas. Sat right in a meeting with his attorney general.
Are we saying now that the three principal wars that the United States has been involved in since 1965?
World War II.
Yeah. Korea. There was
right.
really, I've never seen any drug connection with the Korean War. But we're 100% certain. Everybody knows that the guys with it, we were backing in Saigon for 65 to 75. They were all heroin dealers. They had the Air Force. They were flying it in to the United States. And, of course, there were drugs that were completely infiltrated, saturated the American military in Vietnam. Central America, and we get totally involved in the cocaine trade. There's no doubt about this. The guy, unfortunately, who broke the story in the San Jose paper, Gary Webb, shall we say, a mysterious death. Now,
we were in fact the source to Gary Webb for all his story.
The question now is, what is the opium poppy connection in Afghanistan. Is this just another? Well, this war is just another cover for a big drug operation?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think Danny does either. But the thing we have to remember is there's heroin coming into the United States from Mexico, but there is probably a lot coming in from Afghanistan because they're all being grown again.
Yeah, there's no doubt that they're doing it, but that's not the reason for the war. We have to be careful here, not to give people the impression that the war is a fabrication in order to be able to get out the heroin and the cocaine. What it is it's a byproduct of covert warfare. They want to be able to have a means of funding their operations without Congress having to authorize what they're doing because they don't want them to have to authorize it and or fund it. That's exactly the point.
Well, yeah,
Congress authorizes
and funds them to go over there with troops. But if they want to do secret covert operations that would be obnoxious to the American people, that the American people would not want their tax dollars paying for, their MO has been to use drug money to do it. And the thing that used to drive me crazy when we were doing the Iran-Contra case is I would say, because I'm a very patriotic American, and I was like flabbergasted that these people, these covert operators, now we're not talking about the intelligence guys in the CIA. I mean, there's an element in the CIA, the covert operators, that these guys cared so little about our own kids and our own people that they were perfectly comfortable pumping in either heroin or cocaine into our country and having everybody get addicted. And the line of the administration is always, oh, this is a problem of demand. If we didn't have all this demand, we wouldn't have this problem. But the thing is, if you bring in addictive materials like cocaine and heroin, you can create a demand in about a week. All you have to do is make it available for practically nothing on the street, and pretty soon you've got yourself a bunch of addicts. And then you have a demand.
It's extremely important, though, to point out, I want to make a very specific point, and that is that while it's the covert operations director to the Central Intelligence Agency that are doing these types of operations, it isn't true that the Congress of the United States doesn't know about it.
Right.
The fact is they don't want to be responsible for having to authorize them to do these covert operations. They want to pretend they don't know about them. But we brought all the evidence in directly to John Kerry, gave it totally to his staff. He totally, intentionally, and willfully suppressed the evidence. And they were embarrassed about the fact that we were engaged in such an effective operation, giving them the details of the names of the pilots, bringing pilots in to testify under oath, giving them copies of the shipping invoices, the serial numbers on the weapons, the landing instructions, the landing strips where they were, who the pilots were that were flying them and everything. And then they got so embarrassed that they had to just shut the whole operation down because they thought they could get away with a fake investigation.
Danny, what year was this that you gave Jerry this stuff?
We filed the case in May of 1986. The Democrats took over the control of the Senate in November of 1986. It was in January of 1987 that the Senate Select Committee on Narcotics and Terrorism, under the chairmanship of John Kerry, came into office and started doing the investigation. We brought him information all the way through 1988, all the way into 1989. All the way into 1990, and they just kept on believing that it wasn't possible for us to be able to provide the evidence to them. And what we did is they then had the judge down in Miami order the summary dismissal of our case. That's what happened.
John Kerry is now responsible for two of these things because in 2004. When he won the presidential election and had it stolen in Ohio, and we gave him, chapter and verse of exactly how they stole the 2004 election in Ohio, and his vice presidential candidate, John Edwards, screamed at him not to concede and to deal with this issue. And at noon or 1 p.m. the day after the election, he conceded and went windsurfing. And has yet to say a word about the theft of the 2004.
And that's because he doesn't want to disturb the major establishment because he relies upon them, and they promised him the vice presidency. when Gore ran for the presidency in 2000. But the fact of the matter is that Gore refused to pick John Kerry, for a long story that I've talked about, because he was so angry at Bill Clinton for having lied to him about Lewinsky that he picked Joe Lieberman to be his vice president instead of Kerry. So we knew perfectly well that Kerry was going to be the nominee in 2004. You know, and the problem is that the reason that he took the dive and refused to come public with the information that showed absolutely clearly that the highest levels of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Reagan-Bush administration, including George H.W. Bush himself, who met directly in the West Wing with Felix Rodriguez, who was running the Ilopango air operations that was smuggling the drugs in and the weapons down. We've got direct minutes of the meetings that they had talking about the resupply of the Contras. You know, we got those. I took the deposition of Donald P. Gregg, who was the National Security Advisor for George W. Bush, H.W. Bush when he was vice president, you know, explicitly showing that they were meeting with the head people smuggling the drugs, you know, and John Kerry let them all off in exchange for a promise that he could be president.
We're going to have to continue this. Is Mark Sommer on the line? Did Mark Sommer get in? Has Mark Sommer called in?
Paul Kangas is here.
Paul, I know you're there, and I need I know Mark Sommer is going to call in. Danny and Sarah, you're welcome to stay, or one of you is welcome to stay. I do have to shift gears.
I've got a meeting coming right up here. I got to go.
All right, Danny. Thank you, Danny. She and Sarah Nelson, it's this show. I'd like you to stay if you can. We're going to start talking about Puerto Rico.
You can tell we're lucky to talk about it.
Somebody got a radio going there. Danny, thank you so much. We're going to continue this. I have never thought that I would use this show to plug a Tom Cruise movie, but based on the tremendous research of Danny Sheehan, and who's just been with us, and Sarah, who's going to stay, and Sarah Nelson from the Romero Institute, American Made is according to them, an 85% true exposition of the CIA orchestration and involvement in the triangular trade of shipping guns down to Central America in exchange for cocaine and massive amounts of money during the Iran-Contra situation, the Contra war. It's an astonishing movie and astonishing story. And Danny and Sarah will have you back to talk about it some more. But we have just had American Made and write me about it at solartopia@gmail.com. It's quite an amazing movie, and spread the word because we don't get too many chances at a mainstream Hollywood movie coming out with such a radical treatment. And I understand the alt-right is going crazy over this movie, trying to denounce it. But the fact of the matter is that Ronald Reagan presided over a drug war and put thousands and thousands of people in prison based on the consumption of drugs that his administration brought into the country. You have to wonder what's really going on in Afghanistan now. We have the restoration of the poppy crop in Afghanistan with the suppression of the Taliban and somehow, coincidentally, an opioid epidemic. This, we had a heroin epidemic during Vietnam when these guys were bringing in our guys in Saigon were bringing in heroin. We had a crack and cocaine epidemic in the 80s during the Central American conflict, and now in Afghanistan. Lo and behold, opium is back, and people are dying, and the poppy crop is just going gangbusters in Afghanistan. So, with that, and with the plug again to go see American Made with Tom Cruise, I have Paul Kangas on the line. Sarah, you're with us?
I'm with you.
I am with you.
Yes, Harvey.
And Mark Sommer. We're expecting Mark Sommer to call in. Mark, have you called in?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Hello, Harvey.
Oh, wonderful.
And...
okay, we've got a great crew here again. So I have put out a piece at progressive.org, the magazine's website, Progressive Magazine's website, about how Puerto Rico can, must, and should go 100% renewable and restore not the central grid, but go to microgrids. And I want to give Mark Sommer the lead on this. Mark, we've been talking a lot about microgrids. Tell us exactly how microgrids could transform Puerto Rico. And then, Sarah, I want to talk to you about your CCA operations in California, community choice aggregation. And then Paul will talk about these solar homes that might be hopefully available to go down to Puerto Rico. So, Mark, you want to kick it off? Tell us what could happen in Puerto Rico with microgrids.
Well, as everyone knows by now, Puerto Rico is essentially a blank slate now because the entire utility grid, which was already bankrupt and in decrepit condition, was completely wiped out by Hurricane Maria. In some ways, that's a catastrophe, but in some ways, it's an opportunity, like nothing else we've ever seen, to change the story completely and to start over again with a decentralized system using distributed energy. For the current system, the system they've had up to now, has absurdly been based on fossil fuels. 98% of their energy came from coal, oil, and gas. Only 2% was solar. However, now what we have is a situation where they can return to the two resources they have in great abundance, solar and wind. As an island, they are drenched in sun, and they have the winds of the tropics. In addition, it's a mountainous island, so they have many isolated regions and villages, which are ideal for a decentralized, renewably powered system. Already, Tesla is shipping batteries, and Sonnen, a Germany company, is shipping hundreds of microgrids, again, renewably powered to fit with solar panels. And wind manufacturers are sending complete kits with small turbines, not as big as those 300-foot ones we have in the States, but capable of being installed and immediately used, plug-and-play style. So what we have, instead of a giant centralized power generator run by fossil fuels that would take years and endless permitting and require hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, these are modular, they're small, and they can be put up in a matter of weeks, and in the case of wind turbines, in a matter of hours and days. They're more like diesel, except they don't require the fuel to be brought in from afar. So when you think microgrid, just think of a power grid that is very, very much simpler. It's just your power source, which is either solar array or a wind turbine, and then it's energy storage, which is usually batteries, lithium-ion batteries, and then an inverter to shift from the DC that's generated by the renewable energy to your 110 current that powers our various appliances and systems. That's how simple it is. It has sophisticated software, but these are now a fully mature technology, and they're highly affordable. And what Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands give us is the first opportunity we've ever had to sort of test drive microgrids on a scale where it will really make a difference immediately. And I think there needs to be both an emergency and a long-term plan. First, to provide microgrids for essential services, hospitals and food and fuel and refrigeration and communications, and then a long-term plan for rebuilding the grid, not by the old obsolete 20th century centralized architecture, but by a 21st century architecture that goes back to community power, that is not only community built, but community financed and community maintained.
One quick question, I'm going to go to Sarah. What wind companies have been sending in windmills, do you know?
I don't know the specific ones, but essentially all the American wind manufacturers are sending these kits in. They're shipping these kits right now, and they're doing them free because they really realize that both it's an emergency and it's also a terrific future market, because they see that this is where the future it lies. And
well,
that,
so here's the question. If the Chinese sent a shipload of solar panels to Puerto Rico, would Trump have it sunk? sorry. Okay, we'll leave it at that. Okay, Mark Summer, that's terrific. One other question real quick. The solar panels on the windmills that were in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and that were exposed to the hurricane, how did they do? Were they all wiped out? Do we have a casualty count on how this renewable equipment fared during the windstorms?
No, we don't in Puerto Rico that I've seen, but we have it from Haiti, which was also hit in an earlier hurricane. And about 60% survived of the solar panels survived in the first instance. And what I've been talking with engineers who understand microgrids and solar arrays, and they say that a certain amount of making the arrays, the racks, more robust, and also flipping the solar panels to face down would probably take care of most of that damage in the future. After all, we already create solar panels that track the sun, so we can certainly have them go upside down when you know that there's a hurricane coming. I would also add that just this morning I was talking with staffers at Senator Kamala Harris's office, and they're putting together legislation right now to try to redirect funds that would normally go to rebuilding the current old-style centralized grid to resilient, renewable microgrids.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, Sarah Nelson,
yes,
you're in Santa Cruz, and the model that Mark has been talking about, the microgrid model, you've actually been applying to a certain extent with the CCA, a community choice aggregation business plan. So can you tell us a bit about how that might apply to Puerto Rico?
Well, I don't know legally what's going on there, but if they passed a CCA law in Puerto Rico, which we have done in California, it's been done in Ohio, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, there's seven states that have done this, and of course we need all the states to do this, but if they pass a CCA law, it would say that that citizens in the cities, counties, multi-counties, have the right to form a community choice energy agency, which is a nonprofit, that will order the kind of energy that they want, and then the normal power company, in our case Pacific Gas and Electric, will continue to deliver the energy on the grid and collect the money, and a lot of that money goes back to the community choice the Community Choice Energy Group, that is the nonprofit that is set up, and they will again order the energy for the next year. What that means is, and we just set it up for three counties in Monterey Bay area, for Santa Cruz, San Benito, and Monterey County. This has been a 4.5-year fight. We've been involved in it for a year and a half. And our organization, the Romero Institute, with our Green Power Project, we've doubled the size of this Monterey Bay Community Power Agency, brought in, you know, in terms of numbers of people, customers, and cities and counties. We brought in two counties and 10 cities out of the total, which is 16 cities and three counties. So we doubled it, and it's important because we will, in the next 10 years, with our agency being able to order the energy we want from solar and wind and hydroelectric, but not from, or geothermal, not from nuclear, not from coal, and eventually not from natural gas, we're going to go increasingly renewable every year by ordering renewable energy to be the energy that goes to all of our customers for power in our three counties. That is really important because you can lower emissions really fast this way. And we have to lower emissions all over the world because 2020 is the turning point for climate. After 2020, we are married to some very serious stuff, much more serious than Houston and Florida and what's just hit the Caribbean. And it's really important what we do between now and 2020 in terms of turning the corner on emissions going up in the air. Because there's already a bunch up there, we gotta stop putting it up there. And
But your model, your CCA model, if you could do me a favor and send me what you have about it, let's figure out how maybe it would be applicable in Puerto Rico in terms of reshaping the legal structure of the utility exactly. industry there. Because right now they have a national-owned single provider, which is burning coal. They have a coal burner in Puerto Rico that brings coal in from Colombia, if you can believe that. And then they have, they're burning heavy oil and gas. And what we need to do is, at least based on your extremely successful experience in Central California there, to and Northern, to provide some kind of legal model. Now, I wanted to jump real quickly, Sarah and Mark, to Paul Kangas. Paul is working on, well, Paul, tell us what you're working on here with these solar houses.
Harvey, I have some really great news from Puerto Rico. There was a guy named Hector Santiago who invested $300,000 in 2011 to build this giant solar farm, solar-powered greenhouse in Puerto Rico. His panels, 75% of them survived the storm, and the 25% that were knocked down, he simply picked them up and reconnected them, so he's totally back up on top just weeks after the storm.
Well,
he has 244
weeks.
Panels up.
Fantastic.
So what he's trying to do
panels,
now, he's lobbying the,
panels, the
Puerto Rican government to require pass a solar payment policy like Germany has, like Maine is passing, and to require the utilities in Puerto Rico to pay 69 cents a kilowatt hour for solar energy. That way it creates a way to give the working class of Puerto Rico a small business model so they make money directly off of selling solar energy onto the grid. He is now selling solar energy onto the grid. And
what grid? There's no grid. How is he selling it to whom? Do you have any
he's
documentation
it
on this you
to
can send me?
The grid. And he's selling it to his neighbors. And he's charging up cell phones. But
he's microgridding, basically.
Yeah, he set up a microgrid 6 years ago, right there in around his farm. And so he's helping
his neighbors.
All right,
so whatever you can send on this would be great. And we're getting short on time, Saul. So I need whatever documentation I can get on that would be really great. But
one last thing. We've convinced some of the universities that are holding this solar decathlon in Denver, Colorado. These are houses that were sent to Denver on trains and ships and planes. They're packages. They can now just repackage them. They're going to tear them all down on October 15th and repackage them. We're trying to convince them to ship them either by ship or airdrop them into Puerto Rico off of a Air Force C-130, these giant cargo ships, because these are packages that can be parachuted into Puerto Rico in like 2 or 3 days, so they could set up 11 different communities around Puerto Rico mass producing these highly developed, high technology, 100% solar powered homes that are at the Solar Decathlon in Denver.
Wow, that's amazing. You have to wonder how they'll do in the next hurricane, but at least they'll have something to live in for the time being. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So you're going to send me a list also, I think you did, of the universities that own these houses, and we're going to try and convince them when they're done in Denver to send them not back to the universities but down to Puerto Rico. Is that
Las Vegas, Nevada University is built one of the houses down there in Denver.
Uh-huh. UNLV? Very good.
Yeah.
All right, so that would be a big deal. Mark Summer, have you heard of this one guy's 300-panel operation? And have you heard of any other solar or wind operations in Puerto Rico and how they did in the storm?
I haven't specifically heard about that. Just 2% Sunnova, an American solar manufacturer or solar installer, has already done about 10,000 homes. But we're talking about something that's organized quite differently, and that's where we need legislation that at the federal level that takes the money that's undoubtedly going to be funneled towards Puerto Rico for reconstruction of the grid, and make sure that that money isn't preemptively sent back into the same coffers, because you can bet that there is a lot of pressure to send it back into the same pockets where it's always gone. And we have to make sure that we have not only plans, but a widely supported piece of legislation. Now, I want to make clear that I think that microgrids, that this is a case where it doesn't absolutely have to be left-right, particularly if you don't lead with climate change as a phrase. If you actually lead with energy independence and national security and cost arguments, because the centralized grid is way more expensive and takes way longer. Microgrids are very inexpensive, and you don't have to keep investing in them once they're built. The energy is then free. I wanted to ask Sarah, however, if you'd give me that chance. Sarah, have you thought about your CCA actually investing in microgridding, creating its own solar arrays, its own energy storage at the local level?
Yes. We have always advocated from the very beginning of working with the other parties all involved in this, because we weren't the only ones working. We've done a lot with the Catholic Diocese here and lots of churches, interfaith, to get support to have all this happen. But we have always advocated that the extra money that comes from CCAs, which would have gone to shareholders of Pacific Gas and Electric, but now is a surplus for the nonprofit Community Choice Agency, that surplus, once debts have been paid that are required when you launch, that surplus should be going into the building of local solar farms, local wind farms, so you're developing local jobs, strengthening the local economy, and creating local energy independence. And that's one of the great things that can happen with CCAs. And for instance, in Sonoma, their CCA, which was ahead of ours, ours is the biggest because it's three counties, but it's not the first in California. Sonoma, within something like 3 or 4 years, had $48 million in the bank as surplus.
Oh, my God.
That makes you realize how much surplus there is that's going to shareholders of the big energy companies, and then you know why they have been opposed to these things. You know, it's just like the oil industry is opposed to solar and wind because it cuts into their profits.
Right. Well, you know, there are also other ways the revenue could be raised in addition to those municipal green bonds that could be also bought by local residents and pension funds and university endowments, others. There's a lot of capital that would be available that's looking for places to invest to go green.
Harvey, could I make a comment there? I think
the German
model is a better model, where they have a solar payment policy, so the money goes directly to the working class, to the solar homeowners, and cuts out people like Shell Oil and PG&E from being involved in these things. I think that what's called the feed-in tariff in Germany is the best model. Japan has it. They require the utilities to pay 53 cents a kilowatt hour. Ontario, Canada has it. They require the utilities to pay 88 cents a kilowatt hour. This puts power and money into the hands of the working class and takes it away from the corporations and shuts down. All the atomic energy plants in Germany are being shut down right now. The last one is going to go click offline on Earth Day 2022, and it's because the German model is a superior model to CCA. I don't think CCA would be good for California or Puerto Rico because it's owned by Shell Oil and PG&E. They control the profits.
Well, yes, but it's an evolution.
No, that's not true.
It goes on its way. You three are all in Northern California. Sarah, you're in Santa Cruz, and Mark and Paul, you're both in the East Bay. So I'm going to put you all in touch with each other. And we're almost out of time. Mark Summer, how do people get a hold of you?
Mark, M-A-R-K, at Solarizing, S-O-L-A-R-I-S-I-N-G. Think Solar Rising, S-O-L-A-R-I-S-I-N-G, .net.
And the Sarah Nelson?
Info@RomeroInstitute.org. Info@RomeroInstitute.org.
And Paul Kangas, if people want to support getting these homes flown into Puerto Rico, which I think is an amazing idea, actually, it'd be so cool to see these solar houses flying in. How do they get a hold of you?
My phone number is 415-368-8581, and my email is dr8kangas, dr8kangas at gmail. I'm real easy to find.
Okay, so once again, with Michael Gooding with the CCA, a model with houses flying into Puerto Rico, there are so many steps we can take, and we know that the big money is going to be going into the Congress and trying to rebuild this old fossil fueled grid, and we've got to stop it. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll be back again next week in Solartopia.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.